The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grasso from Bloomberg Radio.
We have a gag order, which to me is totally unconstitutional. I'm not allowed to talk, but people are allowed to talk about me. So they can talk about me, they can say whatever they want, they can lie, but I'm not allowed to say anything. I just have to sit back and look at why a conflicted judge has ordered me to have a gag order. I don't think anybody's ever seen anything like this.
After trial today in the hush money case, Donald Trump complained about the gag order preventing him from disparaging witnesses. Of course, yesterday, it seemed pretty clear that the former president had violated the order on camera, with his attorney looking on, disparaging the prosecution's star witness, Michael Cohen.
Because, as you know, Cohen is a lawyer, represented a lot of people over the years. Now, I'm not the only one. And wasn't very good in a lot of ways in terms of his representation. But he represented a lot of people. But he puts in an invoice or whatever, a bill, and they pay and they go on a legal expense. I got indicted for that. And this is what they try to take me off the trail for. That checks being paid to a lawyer. He is a lawyer, or was a lawyer. And also the things he got in trouble for were things that had nothing to do with me. He got in trouble and went to jail. This had nothing to do with me. This had to do with the taxi cab company that he owned, which is just something he owned, and medallions and borrowing money and a lot of things, but it had nothing to do with me. He represented a lot of people over the years.
Joining me from the courthouse in Lower Manhattan is Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado, who was in the courtroom for some heated arguments this morning over the prosecution's request that Trump be found in contempt of court for his social media posts that they say violated the gag order. Pat, tell us about the prosecutor's argument for finding Trump in contempt and the defense attorney Todd Blanche's argument against.
Well, they said he's repeatedly made these postings on Truth Social and reposted other statements by other people that, as a result, end up criticizing and slamming and characterizing the veracity of the witnesses, which they say is a violation of the gag order. And Todd Blanche was basically saying reposting these statements aren't Trump's fault. That Trump basically, you know, is reposting statements, so it's not Trump's responsibility when he reposts them. It's the people who originally posted them. And the judge was kind of getting a little impatient with Todd Blanche's argument that, you know, you're losing credibility here, called his argument silly at one point.
Todd Blanche also argued that, you know, this was political speech and Trump had the right to respond to a barrage of political attacks from witnesses. And the judge said, you've presented nothing, and I've asked you 8 or 9 times to support your arguments.
There's no evidence because the postings that Todd Blanche was saying Trump was responding to were not about politics or the campaign for president, but were all about Trump commenting on the veracity of the witnesses that were going to testify against him, including Michael Cohen and Stormy Daniels. Blanche also said that Trump didn't know they were going to be witnesses. And the prosecutor, Chris Conroy, said that Trump has known for so long that they are key witnesses in the case. So that was kind of stretching the judge's patience there.
Did the judge lose patience and actually yell at Blanche?
He doesn't ever raise his voice. We'd all be so lucky to be married to Judge Mershon. He's so calm and quiet and never seems to raise his voice or get impatient. He was getting a little testy, but it's never like yelling. His style is just not that. He's very calm, and he was calmly responding, you know, this is not political. Show me where this is political. And at one point, Blanche argued that when Trump was complaining about someone getting a presidential pardon, that that didn't have anything to do with this case. And it also didn't have anything to do with the campaign and his campaign as president. It's not political. And Blanche was insisting it was. I mean, you can see that there were kind of at cross purposes there.
So they're talking about, you know, Trump's posts and reposts, 11 of them. Did anyone mention that yesterday after court, Trump discussed Michael Cohen and talked about him not being a good lawyer outside the courthouse with his own lawyer looking on?
That was not raised, but the prosecutors mentioned that there are other additional times and instances where Trump has, in their view, violated the gag order, which they said they would be providing to the judge as additional evidence to help him make a decision. You know, the other thing that was interesting that kind of caught Todd Blanche was that at one point, Blanche said that Trump was reposting something a Fox TV personality had posted, except that the timestamp of the post showed that Trump posted it first, and he didn't repost what the guy said. He was posting it first. So he wasn't reposting someone else's comments. He was posting his own comments. And the judge basically asked if Trump had manipulated the posting to make it look like he was reposting them when he really wasn't. So who was on first?
Exactly. And the prosecutors didn't even ask for jail time, right? Are they just asking for a fine?
It seems like right now they're sticking to the $1,000 for each of the three original violations, meaning $3,000 total. But they wanted Trump to be warned that he better knock it off and stop doing this. One thing that the judge seemed visibly concerned about was this did not start until after Trump lost a bid to overturn the gag order. He went to the appellate division, apparently, and tried to get a Manhattan appeals court to overturn the gag order. They refused, and then Trump immediately started tweeting and putting on social media and on Truth Social.
And explain the prosecutor's concerns about these posts.
Well, the prosecutors are concerned that many of these statements are basically attacking the credibility of their two witnesses. They're also concerned about postings that Trump had made. The one that was at issue with the Fox TV personality was complaining about the liberal jurors and the Democratic operatives that were on the jury. And they were concerned that this could frighten seated jurors on the case and could cause a mistrial by influencing or intimidating them. They also argued that one of the jurors after the Fox News posting came out is the person who asked to be excused last week on Friday. Because she'd been selected on Thursday, and then she said she couldn't sit anymore, and she didn't want the publicity.
The judge didn't rule on the gag order from the bench, and after the arguments, the first prosecution witness retook the stand, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer. What was his demeanor like on the stand?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, today he didn't have the big smile he did when he first took the stand yesterday. But he gave details about this August 2015 meeting at Trump Tower with Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer and fixer, as well as Trump, where they agreed that he would help Trump in any way by burying salacious news about Trump, as well as helping Trump and trashing any of his opponents in the campaign.
Is that what the prosecution referred to in opening statements as the sort of conspiracy meeting?
Yes. And he said it was really interesting because he said he first met Trump in the 90s and he helped get a magazine together for Trump. And then when Trump started the Celebrity Apprentice, they ended up having a mutually beneficial relationship, he and Trump, because Trump would leak him things about which Celebrity Apprentice was going to get fired. Or, secret developments in The Apprentice or The Celebrity Apprentice, which really drove sales for the National Enquirer and all of their magazines. So he said, quote, I would add that a lot of the contact with someone was going to be fired or terminated. Mr. Trump was kind enough to give me this information first. That was very beneficial for my magazine. He said his magazines, quote, loved Mr. Trump as a celebrity and followed him religiously. And he says, as a matter of fact, they conducted a survey when they asked what people thought of Donald Trump, and it came out that people suggested that he run for president. And that is what boosted Donald Trump into thinking maybe he should run for president.
Which of the so-called catch-and-kill schemes did he describe before court ended?
catch and kill stories he talked about is there was a Trump doorman who claimed that he knew Donald Trump had fathered a love child with a Latina worker at Trump Tower and that he was trying to sell his story. So then Pecker notified Cohen and Trump about this and that Pecker agreed to pay $30,000 for the story to basically buy and bury it. So they paid him $30,000, and then they eventually determined it wasn't true, but they had exclusive rights to the story. And if he went to any other publication, they could collect $1 million from the doorman. But they would release him from this agreement after the election.
So has it been established that Michael Cohen was the point person and that Trump actually designated him as the point person?
Yes, it has been established. According to David Pecker, the person who was his intermediary and the person that was on almost every call that he spoke to, you know, multiple times, almost every day, he said, during the campaign, was Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen would tell him, hey, I've got this. Don't worry. I'm going to check this out. When they talked to the door about the doorman story, he said, that's not true, but let me check it out. So he was definitely very, very involved as a point person that David Pecker dealt with for this.
How is Trump reacting to all this? I remember during jury selection, the judge scolded him at one point, but what's been happening since then?
Well, at times he seems like he's very engaged and was nodding when, for example, during the argument about the contempt hearing, he was nodding his head in agreement with Blanche in his argument that he was only reposting things and that Donald Trump was entitled to respond to being attacked. He's running for re-election. He wants to win the presidency. This is all political speech. So Trump was nodding his head at that. He was very astutely listening to Pecker's testimony. I didn't see any facial reaction, but it could be because I was about 90 feet away from a camera because I was at the last row of the main courtroom.
Not optimal conditions for observing, I guess. Thanks, Pat. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Patricia Hurtado. Coming up, what happens when a non-citizen spouse is denied a visa? I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
The first test today at the Supreme Court in nearly a decade of whether U.S. citizens have a constitutional interest in visa decisions for their foreign spouses. Sandra Munoz has spent the last 8 years fighting the denial of a visa for her husband, a citizen of El Salvador, because of his supposed gang tattoos. But the justices, including the Chief Justice, seem skeptical of her attorney, Eric Lee's arguments that her constitutional rights were violated by the decision.
The rights of a U.S. citizen are implicated, and the position that the government has put Ms. Munoz in is that she's been permanently separated from the man that she loves for 8 years without having any basis, any chance, when there was an opportunity to respond under the regulations, to try and convince them that they made a mistake.
Let me pause just very briefly. She's not been permanently separated from the man that she loves. That person is not allowed to be admitted into the United States.
But at the same time, Your Honor,
question.
And a majority of the justices seem to agree that the government had fulfilled its duty by informing the couple of the reason it denied the visa. Here's Justice Elena Kagan.
Okay, you got what you wanted. You got the information that they were excluding the spouse because of gang activities. And then that brings us back to Justice Gorsuch's questions about why isn't this whole thing over because you got what you wanted.
Joining me to sort through this visa morass is immigration law expert Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. Leon, explain this doctrine of consular non-reviewability, which was created by the Supreme Court.
So here is what happened. Every year, something around the lines of 11 million people apply outside of the United States for a visa. And most of these are called non-immigrant visas, meaning people are coming just to visit or work temporarily. But some are called immigrant visas, meaning some people are coming to try to come here permanently. But they apply abroad for that visa, which is the request to be given permission to enter the United States. And what the consular non-reviewability doctrine says is that if one of the U.S. embassies outside of the country denies your visa application, you cannot sue in federal court saying that the reason that was given was wrong and that a judge should be able to look into that reason and, if they disagree, grant you a visa. And so that has been the law since the 1970s in this case called Kleindienst versus Mandel, which was about professors who were challenging the fact that one of the people they invited to come speak at a university was denied a visitor visa to come visit because they were said that they were communistic concerns. And the question was, what was the due process that was owed there? And could you challenge that? And the court said at that time, and this has sort of continued over various cases, we'll talk about the uniqueness of this case in a minute, but this concept of what is owed to you is a reason, and that that reason actually has to be a reason that is in the law. So the standard is called facially legitimate and bona fide, but what that means in plain English is if there's a reason that is permitted by statute, and so there's a lot of them, there's you're a drug trafficker, there's you've committed a crime of corruption, whatever the reasons that are in the statute for denying a visa, as long as you say that reason, then there's no later trial that can be had. Whereas if you were to say your visa was denied because it's Tuesday and on Tuesdays we just don't grant visas, we deny all of the cases, then maybe you could go to court, although I haven't seen that case either. But the idea is then maybe you could go to court because now they're admitting this was not facially legitimate and bona fide. But if you've cited an actual reason that exists in the law, that's the end of the analysis.
There was a lot of discussion about liberty interests. And the Solicitor General said that you have a liberty interest in living in the United States. You have a liberty interest in living with your spouse, but you don't have a liberty interest in getting your spouse admitted to the United States.
Right. Here's where this case gets complicated. And there was actually a case similar to this case just a few years ago that I was actually involved with. I didn't argue the case before the Supreme Court, but my office handled the case in the lower court. And so I was part of the preparations and the argument for this. That case was called Dinn versus Carey. And it was the same principle, which is, okay, there's a U.S. citizen. This U.S. citizen wants to get married to a foreign national. This happens hundreds of thousands of times a year. And the U.S. citizen either applies for a green card for that person from inside the United States, if they're here, or they apply for an immigrant visa for that person if they're outside the United States. 99% of those cases get approved, but 1% of the time, you will have a case where the State Department says that they cannot allow that person to enter the United States. In the Dinn case, it was about the person being affiliated with the Taliban. And so the question was, well, what information is required? Because what if the government tells you you are affiliated with the Taliban and you say, no, I'm not? Well, what's the recourse there? What can you do about this? The argument in Dinn was, too bad, there is no recourse. They told you the reason, and even if their reason is wrong, there's nothing you can do because they gave you a reason. And the court there assumed without deciding that a person who was a U.S. citizen had some extra right in court vis-a-vis their liberty interest to be reunited with their spouse that just some random foreign national does not have when they apply, let's say, for a visitor visa or a student visa or a work visa or something like that. That this is kind of a heightened thing where a U.S. citizen is trying to reunite with their foreign national spouse in America. But even in Dinn, and now in this case, the idea is, fine, you may have that heightened interest, but at the end of the day, that heightened interest only is being assumed without decided, and really, what is the remedy here? And again, in today's panel, nobody seemed excited about actually giving a remedy called the State Department must make a decision in writing, and then a federal court must review that decision. That nobody seems to be going in that direction even after this case.
Yeah, several of the justices said, basically, you got everything you asked for. What more do you want? Justice Amy Coney Barrett said previous cases don't require that much. You're asking for significantly more. I guess I don't know why this isn't just game over.
Correct. The reason that the Supreme Court needed to review the decision was because the Ninth Circuit actually ruled that what was given initially to this individual litigant was not sufficient, Ms. Sandra Munoz, that this was not sufficient and timely. And so what they were saying is, you know, not only do you have to give it, but you have to give it in a timely fashion. You can't wait many, many months for this. And here's the problem. I mean, just in general, I see this in my practice all the time, which is if you give any agency, even the State Department, who is filled with wonderful professionals who give up a lot of their life to live in very dangerous places all over the world and make very difficult sacrifices for themselves and their families, even there, if you give anybody unchecked power where they know that their decision is not subject to any scrutiny, you risk getting wrong decisions. And I mean, I've seen this in cases where what happens is literally the client that I have has the same four names, you know, let's say a first name, a middle name, and then the two last names, the mother's name and the father's name, but they're two completely different people. There's one person who's a bad, bad, bad actor, and there's my client who's a different actor. And you have to give all of the evidence and hope to God that the State Department will see it and finally realize, oh yeah, oh my gosh, these real, there really are two separate people with both of these names, etc. And so you do see this on occasion, and the Supreme Court is very hesitant to open up that judges can start giving visas in these cases. And then part of the real problem is, once you have sources and methods of intelligence to figure out how people are admissible or inadmissible, what are you going to have to do in order to prove that your decision was right? Are you going to literally have to litigate all of these intelligence sources and say, here's how we know about this person, and then the person can try to impeach those sources? The courts seem to want no part of that, and so this is where this issue is stuck. It is a sympathetic issue, especially when a U.S. citizen wants to be married, but what the courts have held previously and what it seems likely they will hold here is, look, nobody's telling you you can't be married. Nobody's denying you that piece of paper. But if the United States has certain interests to exclude people from entering, those interests overcome the interest to be married, because you can still be married. If you need to, you can move to the country where the other person is, as opposed to having that person come to the United States. And so that's the argument being made. Now, one other minor point about this case, which is actually very important, is that the problem with this case is that the actual reason the person was denied, even though they did cite a statute, which is all that's required.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Just was a statute which talked about that the person is likely to come to the United States and commit crimes, meaning it wasn't even citing any past behavior. It was citing a statute that says you are likely to be coming here to commit crime. And then later they provided context that they believe the person was a gang member and a member of MS-13. But the problem that some of the justices had with that statute is, hey, you know, if you're not even going to allow someone to come in based on something you think they're going to do, as opposed to something they did, how is that fair? And so there was some of that discussion, but I think that's just going to be for the three more progressive justices as opposed to the six more conservative justices.
Stay with me, Leon. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, we're going to talk about how the justices might rule in this case and some of the concerns that the case raises. I've been talking to Leon Fresco of Holland & Knight about Supreme Court oral arguments today about the question of whether U.S. citizens have a constitutional interest in visa decisions for their foreign spouses. So, Leon, I'd like to ask you a question about what happens in practice. Let's say you live in this country and your spouse lives in a foreign country. He or she gets rejected for a visa. That rejection, is that reviewed by someone higher in the State Department than the consular office who rejects the person?
So what happens is, in a situation where there's a rejection by a State Department official, the only real things that people do, like, you know, in those types of frameworks are, number one, there is an administrative review that you can ask if you believe there is a legal error. Technically, they don't even acknowledge an administrative review process for a factual error, but they have a thing called LegalNet that allows, if there's a legal error, that legal error can be reviewed. And then what people also do sometimes is they try to involve members of Congress by explaining the case and getting some sympathy and seeing if the member of Congress can ask the State Department for more information and potentially be a mediator or a conduit to say, hey, maybe you've misinterpreted this because you don't really understand that you have the wrong person or something. And so these visa adjudications end up having a very quasi-administrative adjudication and a quasi-political adjudication. And because of that, because it's not really a legitimate, fair adjudication, and there's really a lot of gray area there, people then start to, because they are desperate, then they start to move toward those gray areas. Let me try to get media coverage on my case. Let me try to get congressional support for my case. Let me try to get, you know, other State Department officials to weigh in and see if they can weigh in with their colleagues on this case, et cetera, et cetera. Because there's no actual fair appellate process to follow, people take matters into their own hands and try to figure out any way possible to try to influence the State Department. But if none of those work, there's no official adjudicative appellate process that one can access.
How did this case get up to the Ninth Circuit then? And then there's a case that got up to the D.C. Circuit.
Yeah, what happens is then people sue, and they sue under the Ex Parte Young Doctrine, where you can sue an officer in their official capacity. So they sue the Secretary of State, and they say that the Secretary of State violated the Administrative Procedure Act by issuing essentially an arbitrary and capricious decision that didn't provide the information required in past cases. And so that's what they said. And what the court is revisiting for what is basically the fourth time, because there was a ruling in, like I said, Kleindienst versus Mandel in the 70s about the communist professors. Then there was Din versus Kerry about the woman in Afghanistan. She was a U.S. citizen, and they said that the husband was a terrorist, that they lost. Then there was Trump versus Hawaii about the travel ban. Could you just ban people? And they also had a consular non-reviewability problem. And this is now the fourth case with regard to this gang membership issue. And this will probably be the fourth time that the Supreme Court says, look, what do you want us to do? There's nothing we can do here.
So now, as I mentioned, several of the justices were saying, you got what you're entitled to. What else do you want, basically? And the lawyer for the spouse said that they wanted a declaration from the court that the State Department's reason for denying the visa was inadequate. Is there any chance at all that the Supreme Court would do that?
I just don't see it, because there's no way to do that in all but the rarest of cases where there's any kind of security concern, this case included, without having this problem of sources and methods and then having a mini little trial in the federal court. And so that's what the courts are trying to avoid, is all of that. You wonder if one day an identification case could come forward where it's literally the person is trying to convince the State Department, I'm not the person you think I am. You know, I'm the other person with that name. But the real truth is they tend to solve those. It might take them a while, but they tend to solve those. And if you really are the other person, they figure it out. And so, especially in these days where there's many, many more digital fingerprints out there, literal and figurative digital fingerprints, where you can really show who's who, those types of cases get solved. It's not that they don't happen. They happen all the time, but they get solved. And so when it's these kind of cases where you're essentially questioning sources and methods and conclusions, I just don't see the courts ever getting there.
So, Leon, this is just curiosity, because there are so many movies where when someone marries a person from another country, they investigate whether the marriage is real or not.
Correct.
Do they
Correct.
Still do that?
So there's two, again, aspects of this. The one is if the marriage takes place inside of the United States, and both parties are in the United States, there is an interview which takes place here in the United States where both people come in and there's an adjudicator who asks about the marriage to both of them. Sometimes they separate the people, but not all the time. In fact, it's not even common to separate the people unless there's some suspicion that there's a problem, meaning, you know, the first few questions, we're already having serious issues. One person doesn't know the other person's parents or their birthday or where they got married or something. Okay, now we're having a crazy issue. We got to split them up and see what's going on. In these cases, oddly enough, where the foreign national is living outside of the United States, they don't actually force the U.S. citizen to come and attend the interview abroad. They only ask the foreign national to come, and it's through those questions to the foreign national that they try to determine the bona fides of the marriage. Here, there wasn't really a question as to the bona fides of the marriage. The larger question was, you can have the most bona fide marriage of all time. If you are still in one of these, what are called inadmissibility grounds, you can't get in. And the obvious ones would be, look, if you murdered somebody, it doesn't matter that you're in a bona fide marriage. You can't come in the country because you murdered somebody. The problem with this case is that the ground that they used was, we believe you will enter the United States for the purpose of committing crime. And so that is a little bit of a harder pill to swallow, if we're being honest, because at the end of the day, that's a speculative determination. But I don't think the court's still going to do anything about that.
Did you ever see that movie, The Proposal?
I've seen all of those movies. You know, there's actually a great Judge Posner decision on this, where I think he gets it right about marriage and immigration, which is he basically says, look, we've got to get out of this business of trying to figure out if a marriage is legitimate or not. What we have to figure out is, did money change hands? And if money changed hands, okay, that's a fraudulent marriage. But if people are getting married, like in The Proposal, for instance, where he says, look, I want to marry you because I love you enough that I want to start dating you, you know, and I care so much about you, I don't want you to leave the country. Why is that not a more bona fide marriage than somebody that got married for the purpose of taking the other person's wealth, you know? And so these are the difficulties of getting into this business.
I tell you, Leon, you not only watched it, but you can quote it. I love that.
I'm a big movie quoter there. Oh. I have actually one of the most famous immigration marriage cases of all time, where they actually changed the law after. And it was a case I was forced to take pro bono by my law firm when I was a very, very young lawyer, about a woman who married a guy on death row. And the Immigration Service said that was not a legitimate marriage because you cannot consummate the marriage because the person was sitting there in death row. And our argument was, well, what does consummating the marriage have anything to do with this? If you want to say some other reason, like, hey, the guy's on death row, fine. But the problem was, this woman moved from Denmark to the middle of Florida in a rural, very, very depressing place where you would never move to unless you truly love the person. She visited him every time there was visiting hours. She called him every time she was permitted to make a call. And later, she actually exonerated him, which was amazing.
Really?
But yes. But the point of this was, they weren't recognizing that. It's like, well, who's moving from Denmark to this rural town in Florida that's very depressing for no reason, you know, to stay in America. That's not what's happening. That she loves him, whether that's misguided or not. But then they ended up actually changing the law, and it was part of something called the Adam Walsh Act, and they said, look, you can't get a green card based on a marriage to someone who's been convicted of a number of crimes. And so, fine, I mean, it is what it is, but, you know, because I was the lawyer at that time, I said that wasn't the law at that time, and so this argument that the problem was consummation of the marriage, that can't be a thing, because we all know there's all kinds of people with all kinds of problems, and we can't say that they can't get married. What are we doing here?
I see why the law firm partners gave you the case, because when I was an associate, I also got cases like that that they thought were unwinnable. Yes. But you
exactly.
won. Thanks so much. That's Leon Fresco, a partner at Holland & Knight. Joining me now is Daniel Pierce, a partner with the Government Strategies and Compliance Group at Fragerman, Del Rey, Berenson, and Lowy. After hearing this argument, do you think that the justices are going to reverse the Ninth Circuit?
I think that, unfortunately, the arguments were pretty muddled, right? There were some very complicated questions. There was a lot of back and forth about the nature of the constitutional right at play here and how to define it. You know, does a U.S. citizen have a right to marry who he or she wants? Does that right include, you know, living with the person? Does that right include living with the person in the United States? So there was a lot of back and forth about that. And then you also heard very muddled discussions about if there's a right here, if the U.S. citizen has a constitutional right at play, how robust is that right? What does the State Department have to give the court? What do they have to say? For example, do they have to say, this is the statute we're keeping you out under, or do they have to say, we think you're a criminal because of X, we think you're in a gang, we think you're in a specific gang? Justice Alito at one point was pressing for specificity. So really, one thing that started happening toward the end of the argument is the justices were puzzling through what's left after the Ninth Circuit's ruling, because here the Ninth Circuit had already forced the government to give some specificity to the reason for the denial, and you know, it isn't clear what more there is to do. The government basically wants them to reverse the Ninth Circuit and just say, in the future, we don't have to say very much when we deny someone at a consulate. And, you know, last time in Kerry v. Dinn, when the Supreme Court looked at this case, they split in a lot of different ways. And there's a hope, I think, that they'll find a majority this time, but I'm just not quite sure what that majority is going to say and which of the questions they're going to answer which way.
Because, I mean, did it seem to you that any of the justices were sympathetic to the idea of providing more information or providing some kind of a process to appeal a visa denial? I mean, did it seem like there was any sympathy for that?
I think that there was at least some sympathy for common scenarios and common problems that you see at consulates. Justice Kagan, for example, was bringing up, you know, what if the person before the consular officer isn't the person that they think? You know, it's John Doe who has the criminal record and not John Doe that's before them, and there's a mistake. I think that a lot of the justices were basically on board with perhaps requiring a bit more information from the State Department than a simple statute, but probably not very much more. You know, Justice Kagan was saying, well, now that you know that they think it was his tattoos that meant that he's an MS-13, don't you have enough to basically go back and present your case to the consulate? So I think if they find that there's a right and if they think that that the consulate needs to provide more, it's unfortunately not going to be very much more. It's going to need to be, you know, a sentence or two. Several of them were saying, well, what if a consulate gave you a sentence or two about why they're keeping you out? Isn't that enough? I don't think it's going to be the sort of more robust, you know, written analysis that Munoz was pushing for.
Besides this particular scenario, are there other cases that would be implicated by the decision here?
Well, my concern, I'm an employment immigration lawyer largely, and my concern is that depending on how they rule, they could really impact other kinds of constitutional rights that might find their way into court. So, you know, if a business is sponsoring their CEO for a green card abroad and that CEO gets a similar kind of denial, does the business have some sort of property right or some sort of other constitutional right to learn a bit more so they can help their CEO through it? That's not directly implicated in Munoz, but it certainly could be foreclosed or given the green light, depending on exactly how the Supreme Court talks about the way that they look at constitutional rights in this area. And the justices were also raising, you know, sort of mission creep problems, I would say. You know, does a U.S. citizen have the right, have constitutional rights concerning bringing his parents or his kids to the U.S. the same way he does his spouse, which is a complicated question. And the government was pointing out, look, we deal with a million cases a year and we deny 62,000 of them. And implicitly it was, do you really want to have 62,000 visa denials on the federal court docket? if you know, you find a constitutional right here, you're going to be faced with a bunch of constitutional rights.
What's the process if, let's say, someone you're representing, the visa is denied, an employment visa? Is there an appellate process?
The problem is that there isn't much effective process. So that was actually something the justice is also focused on as well. Like, what are you planning to do with this information if we say you're entitled to it? And you are entitled to go to the State Department and say, hey, you got this wrong. You know, you should reconsider. You have to do that within a year. It's common enough to also send someone back in for another visa interview. But the problem on a practical level is that if you don't know why they think your client is a criminal or they think your client is a terrorist or what have you, effectively, it's not quite clear how you prove the negative. What do you send them in with to convince the State Department that it got it wrong? And so without even the bare bones minimum of he's an MS-13 because of tattoos, which is what Munoz was ultimately able to get, you're sort of left in the dark. You know, all you're told is the State Department believes your client to be a criminal and you somehow have to prove that he's not. You know, but what does that mean? It's sort of like Minority Report. We think you're going to commit a crime at some point in the future, but we don't have to tell you what crime or when or why we think that. How are you supposed to, as an attorney or as a client, you know, really defend yourself in that kind of circumstance?
Thanks so much for being on the show, Daniel. That's Daniel Pierce of Fragerman, Delray, Burnson and Lowy. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.